Today at Reader's Corner, Sandra Matz, author of the new book Mind Masters, The Data-Driven Science of Predicting and Changing Human Behavior. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. In her new book Mind Masters, Columbia Business School professor Sandra Matz reveals the fascinating detail how big data offers insights into the most intimate aspects of our lives. As algorithms become increasingly adept at accessing the human mind, they also become more and more powerful at controlling it, enticing us to buy a certain product or vote for a certain political candidate. Some say this technological trend is no big deal. Others consider it one of the greatest threats to humanity. But what if the truth is more nuanced and mind-bending than that? Sandra Matz is a computational social scientist whose work has been featured in Psychological Science, American Psychology, the BBC, the World Economic Forum, and elsewhere. She also serves as the co-director of the Center for Advanced Technology and Human Performance at Columbia University. And once again, the name of the book, Mind Masters, The Data-Driven Science of Predicting and Changing Human Behavior. Sandra Matz, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you so much, Bob. It's a pleasure to join you today.
So why don't we start off with the very basics? What is what you call psychological targeting? And how does it differ from its traditional counterparts we may have seen on TV forever?
It's funny because the way I think about psychological targeting in its basic form is really the ability of algorithms to penetrate and decode our minds. And what I mean by this is essentially taking all of the digital traces that we generate these days as we interact with technology. That goes all the way from what you post on social media to your credit card swipes to the phone, the data that gets captured by your phone without you really thinking about it twice, and how algorithms can take all of these data traces, translate it into meaningful psychological insights. So anywhere from your personality, your values, your political ideology, and then use these insights in a second step to say, okay, once we understand someone's motivations, needs, preferences, fears, desires, how do we use these insights to potentially change the way that someone thinks, feels, and behaves? So kind of really these two stages of making sense of who you are based on data, but then also using these insights to potentially impact your choices and the decisions that you make.
And you set up for the reader two arguments that might be the foil for you in this argument. First of all, the fallacy of, well, it's worth it. I like the fact that I got some help getting in touch with things that relate to whatever it is I did yesterday on Google. And the other one is, hey, I've got nothing to hide. I don't care if they use my data. And you respond to both of those. Why don't you share with our listeners just right off the bat here how you deal with that?
First of all, I think there's something to it, right? So the idea that sharing your data oftentimes gives you amazing perks, right? If you don't have your GPS tracking on, then Google Maps can't help you get from A to B. Nobody wants to go to page 2 on Google because we want to see what we're interested in on the first page. Like, nobody wants to spend hours on Netflix trying to find the best movie. So I think there's certainly something to be said about using our data being extremely helpful. Now, what I would argue is that that's true in some instances. It's certainly not true in all instances, right? If you think about governments potentially collecting a whole swath of data about us and companies collecting very intimate data traces, and then instead of using it to help us, it potentially exploiting us to get us to do some things that we don't want to do. So I think that what's top of mind for us is oftentimes, how does data help us? And we forget that there's so many instances where the data that is being collected is certainly not used in our best interest. And that also kind of brings me to the second one, which is this idea that, well, I don't have anything to hide, so I'm not worried about my data being out there. I'm not worried about potentially third parties invading my privacy. And I also to some extent get that argument, because it feels like an uphill battle oftentimes, right? It feels like, well, we've lost control anyway, so why don't we just kind of go with the flow and deal with it? What I would say is, First of all, it's a very privileged position to be in. It doesn't apply to everybody. If you don't worry about your data, that just means that you're currently in a good spot, right? If I can predict maybe your mental health status, your sexual orientation, like your income, that in many ways can be used to discriminate against you. And for me, that the almost more critical part is that even if you're not worried about this today, you don't know what tomorrow holds, because the way that I think about it is like data is permanent, but leadership isn't, right? So it could be that data gets collected today and you don't have to be worried because maybe you're just in a good spot, but that could very quickly change. And that's true for governments, right? So I think about my own home country. So I grew up in Germany. If you think back, like a few decades ago, Germany was a democracy. And then from one day to the next, it wasn't. And data actually played a really big role in the context of the Jewish communities across Europe. So if you think back to the Second World War and Nazi Germany going to these different countries in Europe, it was extremely easy in those countries where religious affiliation was part of the census to just go to City Hall, find the names and addresses of the members of the Jewish community, and then go kind of take them and evict them from their homes. You can imagine that, like, you don't need City Hall data anymore to make similar predictions. So even if currently you don't feel like you have anything to hide or you have to be worried about your data, just the landscape changes so quickly. And it doesn't even have to be governments, right? It could be the leaders of companies who maybe have like a different spin on what they want to do with the data that they collect. So this notion of I don't have anything to worry about because I don't have anything to hide is both privileged and also potentially short-sighted, because you just don't know what tomorrow is going to bring.
And in order for these companies to use our data, they first of all have to know just who we are very specifically. How does the computers translate our digital footprints into the intimate predictions of who we are? I think in your book, you talk about the most popular scientific model of personality.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny because I think that in a way, the way that computers learn is not so dissimilar to how humans learn. So if you think about how do you make judgments about the people around you, right? So you see someone on the street wearing like a flashy jacket and like super bright colors, you probably have a sense of like, oh, that person is probably very self-confident, maybe a bit more extroverted because they want to stand out from the crowd rather than blend in. And we base this on observations, right? We base this on experience because we've seen many people and then we've interacted with them and we've just figured out, yeah, those people maybe who feel more confident dressing up in bright colors, maybe they're also more extroverted. And computers in a way learn the same way. So they see many, many data points, right? They're much better at integrating millions of data points, millions of observations from millions of people. And then they learn patterns. So they just see, on average, if you spend more money going to the pub, surrounding yourself in like social settings, you're probably more extroverted. If you spend more money on pets, you're probably more agreeable and caring and trusting. If you spend more money on books and gardening equipment, maybe you're like a little bit more introverted. So what computers do is they just really sample behaviors from the population and connect it with some of these more psychological insights and create these relationships of saying, yeah, on average, people who show a certain behavior are also kind of this type of person when it comes to their psychology. And they're just really good at doing this at scale.
And I might say for our readers who are going to pick up a copy of this book, they can take the Big Five test.
Yeah. So the Big Five, it's funny because the Big Five is the most popular model that we have of personality right now. And in a way, it's an oversimplification of the complexity of all of us, right? If I've spent the last 20 years with my spouse, I get to know him really, really well. I don't necessarily need the Big Five to figure out who he is and what he's probably going to do. But the Big Five is incredibly helpful to, first of all, kind of get a sense of who is someone that I don't know as well. So if you were to meet a stranger on the street and you get a sense of, are they more neurotic or emotionally stable? Are they more organized or more disorganized, more extroverted or more introverted? You get a pretty good sense of like, here's maybe what they would be interested in when it comes to having a conversation. Here's maybe how they're going to react in a certain situation. So the Big Five, the reason for why psychologists like the framework so much is, first of all, it's stable across different cultures, different social demographic groups. So it's like one of these models that really pops up time and again. And it's also related to so many of the outcomes and like actions that people take that we care about, anywhere from which profession might you be interested in, like which music do you like life satisfaction. There's so many ways in which the big five predict these life outcomes that matter, that it's just like a really interesting model to keep in mind.
Today at Reader's Corner, Sandra Matz, author of the new book, Mind Masters, The Data-Driven Science of Predicting and Changing Human Behavior. How do Facebook likes predict a whole range of characteristics, which I assume then inform digital advertisers how to aim their products at us?
Anything that's social media is actually interesting for psychologists because it's what we call identity claims. So identity claims are these very explicit signals of how you want to see yourself and how you want the world to see you, right? This was always true in an offline context too. If you have a poster up in your office of Taylor Swift, that's probably going to say something about who you are. If you have a bumper sticker on your car, that's also a very explicit signal of here's who I am. And social media is just doing this in a digital space, right? We kind of talk about the stuff that matters to us. We follow some of the pages that resonate with our preferences. And it was the first kind of really data source that I think scientists looked into almost 10, 15 years ago now. So making these connections between here's the pages that you like on Facebook, and here's what you post in your status updates, and a whole range of psychological outcomes like personality, values, political ideology, IQ, life satisfaction. And I think what we learned pretty quickly is that computers are just very good at making these connections between what you write about, what you like, and these psychological characteristics. And one of my favorite studies was actually a colleague of mine at Cambridge, because she said, well, how do we know how good computers are at making these predictions? Like oftentimes we just have like these statistics out there that say, well, the correlation between your self-reported personality and a computer-based prediction is a 0.5, and it doesn't mean anything to most people. So what she said is, why don't we compare the computer to people in our environment who should actually know us pretty well? So if I take a personality test and I tell you if I think of myself as more extroverted or more introverted, I'm going to give a computer access to my Facebook profile, to the things that I like on Facebook. And I'm also going to ask my coworkers, my friends, my family members, and my spouse to complete the questionnaire on my behalf. So they tell me, it's like, here's how I think Sandra would answer this question. And now you can pit the computer against people in our environment that should know us pretty well. And what she found, and this is like now really 10 years ago with relatively simple models and only access to your Facebook likes, she found that a computer outperformed coworkers, outperformed friends, outperformed family members. So those include kids, siblings, parents, so people who should know you pretty well because they spend a substantial amount of time with you and observe your behavior across a whole range of different contexts. And still the computer, just by accessing your Facebook likes, was better at predicting your personality than all of these people. It was a little bit worse than the spouse, which I think made a lot of people feel great about themselves. But you can also imagine that with like a lot more data sources and maybe more sophisticated models right now, a computer would probably also outperform our closest confidant, if you want.
So let's go back to Google for a moment. I have DuckDuckGo on my computer. I must admit, for some reason I can't even explain, I don't use it as often as Google, but I went on the website this morning and I found their advertising, so to speak. Search privately and block trackers, block annoying cookie pop-ups, hide your email address, watch YouTube without targeted ads. That sounds pretty good to me. Tell me what it looks like to a computational social scientist.
Yes, it's funny because in a way, it's oftentimes a trade-off, right? So YouTube is the prime example. So in YouTube, there's now an option to say, I don't want any personalization. I don't want you to take my history to make recommendations. And I've done this experiment where on my desktop, so my laptop, I actually have the personalization on. So every time I go on YouTube, it knows which music I've listened to before, like which videos I've seen. And then on my phone, it's complete every time I start from scratch. And I have to say that there's something extremely annoying about the fact that you have to start from scratch every single time, right? So it's bedtime for my son. I want to pull up a song, one that he liked before, and I just can't find it anymore because it's not in my history. Mm-hmm. So oftentimes there's this trade-off that we have to that we face right now is, yeah, you can either protect your privacy with search engines or with like switching off like the history, but then you don't really get the convenience and you don't really get the service. And for me, if I think about where would I want this to go, is I think we have to eliminate this trade-off for people, right? If the trade-off is I can protect my privacy, but then I also give up the service and convenience, I think most people will naturally gravitate to the convenience in the moment, because that's what the brain is made for, right? We kind of tend to gravitate to the immediate mm-hmm. rewards, and we don't necessarily, like, privacy is like such an abstract construct. We don't really know how it's going to impact us in the here and now and in the future. So if it's a trade-off, I think most people will go just with service and convenience, but there are now technologies which actually allow you to protect your privacy in a much better way without having to sacrifice this personalization. And what I'm thinking about specifically is something that's called federated learning, which is a way in which you can personalize experience without necessarily having to collect the data in a central place. So the way that Apple, for example, train Siri, so the voice recognition software that they have on their products, is instead of collecting all of your speech data, so instead of taking all of your conversations, sending them to Apple so that they can get a kind of train the model and get a better model, make sure that they recognize your voice, they say, why don't we send the intelligence to you? So we have a model that recognizes speech, and you have a super powerful computer in your back pocket, right? So your phone is so much more powerful than the computers that we used to launch rockets to space with just a few decades ago. So what Apple can do is they can say, well, we have all of this intelligence. We're going to send it to your phone. We're going to locally process. We learn how you speak. We learn how to recognize your voice, how to respond appropriately. And now we can send the intelligence back. So the data itself never leaves your phone. So you don't give up on this really substantial piece of your privacy, but you still get the service and convenience. The same is true, like YouTube could do this, right? So YouTube could say, we're going to take the data that's on your phone. We're going to send you a model that just taps into whatever data is on your phone, but we don't share this data with YouTube. We're just locally going to personalize. And then maybe we'll share back some intelligence. If this is a video that you enjoyed, maybe you also enjoyed some other ones, but the data itself is protected. And for me, that's the world that I want us to move us in. I don't want people to have to face these trade-offs and have to spend hours trying to figure out how to protect their privacy, because nobody has the time, right? If I have to make a decision of, am I now going to go through all of the terms and conditions, delete my cookies, delete my browsing history, or spend a quality meal with my family, I would probably prefer spending that meal with my family. And I think that's what we need to do. We just need to make it easy for people to eliminate this trade-off.
So how is federated learning accessed? Is this something that I have to find on my computer? Or are you talking about something that's built into the Apple system, for example?
Yeah, so this is something that actually has to be built out in the system, which is also one of the reasons for why it takes a little while, I think, to be implemented across more products than just like Apple and Google. But yeah. There's a pretty big shift, because especially Google has made a lot of the developments that they've done in that space publicly available. So there's many open source pieces of code now that you can take as a company and implement. It requires a little bit of a shift initially, mm-hmm. but it's really a way for companies to say, we can offer this service and convenience without mm-hmm. necessarily having to collect the data.
You have a statement in your book, quote, your credit card knows exactly what, where, and when you buy. I'd love to know more about that. First of all, how? Secondly, this is one of those moments where I could play your foil and say, I don't care. What do I care? Unless in fact, is the credit card company selling what they've learned about my purchases to somebody who can then use them more effectively? Because I can't think of a way that my credit card company can really influence my purchasing the way Amazon can, when all of a sudden these products show up at the bottom of the page that are related to what I just purchased.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, credit card spending is interesting because we know that spending is so personal, right? So it's personal on a psychological level in the sense that what you spend your money on kind of signals a little bit of like who's the person behind it. But it's also personal in the sense that it's almost this unique fingerprint. So there's like this really interesting study that was coming out of MIT where they looked at, is it possible? Let's say you give me anonymized credit card spending data from all of Manhattan. So millions of people. It's not attached to names, not attached to date of birth or anything that we would traditionally consider as personally identifiable. All I have is your credit card spending. Now, if I now know that you, Bob, you bought, like you went to Starbucks in the morning in a certain location and bought a latte and a cappuccino and maybe a croissant, then you went to have lunch in a certain place and maybe you took a cab from one place to another, suddenly, even though there's no names in the data, but I know these three data points, I can very quickly find you in the data, right? Because there's only one person in this entire data set who has this unique signature. So the reason for why spending is so intimate in a way is that it kind of creates this like, I'm feeling kind of almost like a fingerprint, and it's almost impossible to anonymize data. Now to the question of like, why does it matter? You're absolutely right in that credit card companies are constantly selling data to third parties. Mm-hmm. And you can imagine that once I understand, first of all, like once I understand here's some of the products that you've been interested in before, I can also make predictions of here's what you're going to buy next. But I can take it a step further and say, well, your spending in a way is reflective of how impulsive are you, right? Like how impulsive are you when it comes to your purchases and then translating that into psychology. And once I have that understanding, well, there's like that's probably something that companies want to know both internally. Should I give you a loan? How expensive should that loan be for you? If I know that you're maybe not as organized, maybe you have a lower likelihood of paying back that loan. Well, you just have to pay me a premium. If I understand that you're more neurotic and maybe a little bit less conscientious, maybe that's a great target for insurance companies, right? Because you're worried about the future and you're also kind of going to get into your, like if you're conscientious, you're not going to get into accidents. So perfect customer. And maybe I'm going to get you to reach a little bit deeper into your pocket. So for me, it's really the second step of once I understand your lifestyle, your habits, your preferences, maybe some of the limitations, I can use that to influence your behavior. And sometimes that's helpful.
So Sandra, as a way of managing our data better, tell us the story of Apply Magic Sauce. What is it and how does it work?
Yeah, so Apply Magic Sauce was actually it's a website that we developed when I was still at the Psychometric Center in Cambridge, which was really kind of trying to give people an understanding of here's how your data can translate into like these really more intimate psychological traits. So people could upload their Facebook data, could upload, I think they could connect it to LinkedIn, to Twitter, and then get like a reading of here's how this translates into your psychology. And the reason for why we set this up was like I was very much like a strong believer of once we just kind of make this process a bit more transparent and we tell people how intimate their data is, they're going to wake up to this reality and they're going to be much better at managing their data. I should say that I still believe that's necessary, right? I still want people to kind of have an opportunity to access their data, have control over their data, but I don't think it's enough. And I see this actually with myself. So I think about this context, like this topic, pretty much 24/7. I think a lot about here's the dangers when it comes to privacy, self-determination. And I don't do a good job managing my data, right? I oftentimes get asked, like, what do you personally do differently now that you know how your data could be used against you? And I'm like, I just don't stand a chance. I still don't have the time to go through the terms and conditions and kind of manage my data in a very responsible way.
How do Europe's general data protection regulations and California's Consumer Protection Act protect consumers' privacy? And I think you did some checking in with some of your friends on whether or not this was properly used.
Yeah, so what these regulations do mostly is they try to protect consumers by making it more transparent, right? So this idea that companies have to tell you what data they're collecting, they have to tell you what's going to happen with that data. You have the right to delete your data, for example, or to take it to another entity. And then it essentially is like this transparency and control, which is an amazing starting point. So the idea behind this is great, because without any control, there's almost nothing that you can do. But it still makes it so hard for people to exercise this right, because like if you think about the fact that you would now have to go into all of your products and services and regularly have your data deleted, it's an annoying process. You have to email them, you have to ask for it, you don't really know if it's going to happen, so you have to follow up. So it's just the way that it's set up, it's really, really difficult for you and me to actually exercise this right to control. And in that sense, I've started to compare it to this metaphor of like you sailing your own boat, like being the captain of your own boat in the Mediterranean Sea, where you can only go to nice places and the weather is nice and the sea is calm, is great, right? In this case, being in control is great because you can only make good choices, but that's not the environment that I would argue we're currently in. I think right now it's more of a raging thunderstorm. There's like so many emergencies that require your attention. Oftentimes we don't have the expertise because technology moves so fast, and we also don't have the time to deal with it all in the like in a 24/7 that we have in a week. So in that context, I think this notion of transparency and control that the GDPR pushed for and the CCPA pushes for example, is much more of a burden than it really is a right. So what I kind of talk a lot about in the book is this idea of how do we make it easier for people, right? How do we tame the sea? And probably more importantly, how do we give people a competent crew? How do we make it such that they're not just alone fighting this problem, but they actually have support of people who have like a similar interest in data and kind of come together as communities to kind of essentially say, here's how we want to maximize the value that we can get from data.
Changing the default, I believe you call it.
Yeah. So changing the default is like how I think of as like calming the sea. So it's like making it easy for people to do the right thing. Right now, if you want to have your data protected, most of the time you have to opt out, right? So you have to say, no, I don't want you to track my data, which means that nobody's going to do it because we're kind of lazy and we have better stuff to do. You see this, like the best example of defaults, of the power of defaults, actually comes from organ donations. So there's this like very well-cited study where they looked at countries where the default for organ being part of an organ donation registry is either opt in or opt out. So that means either you have to actively sign, say, I want to be part of this organ donation registry, or you say everybody gets enrolled and you can say, I don't want to be part of that. And the differences in terms of enrollment numbers are massive. So even though in all countries, most people say it's a good thing to do because we know that it saves lives, if you look at the countries that have this opt-in, so you actively have to say, I want to be part of this, the number of people, like the percentage of people hovers around 10%. So most people say it's a great idea. About 10% manage to actually do it. In the countries where there's an opt-out, the number is about 97%, 98%. Just because like by default, without you having to take any action, you're just enrolled. And most people don't take the time to kind of, even if they don't want to be part, to say, no, like I'm gonna not do that. And the same is true for the data world. There's like the opposite, right? Currently, it's just like everybody's opted in and you actively have to say, no, I don't want you to track my data, which means that most people are going to stay enrolled in the data tracking. So if you were to change the default, that would mean that, first of all, as companies, you would have to live up to your promises of using data in a way that creates value. Because if you don't show your customers how you're going to make their experience better, you just wouldn't get the data. So there's like this argument that it's not just protecting people's privacy, but it could also make the products better. Because now companies really have to live up to their promises, or they don't get the data that they want and need.
I have time for one more question, Sandra, yes. And it's going to be the data co-op. How does the data co-op work and how does it achieve the goal of preserving our privacy?
Yeah, it's one of my favorite examples. And it comes back to this metaphor of the sailing boat and like just helping people get this competent crew to support them. So data co-ops, I think of them as like these small communities of like-minded people who have a shared interest in using data. So I think what regulation typically does is it tries to mitigate risk for the average person, right? It says we want to protect your privacy to some extent, so let's make sure that we kind of eliminate the most egregious abuses, but it doesn't help you make the most of your data and maximize the utility that you can get, the value that you can get. So data co-ops, in a way, say there are certain people who have shared interest in using data that could be anywhere from expecting moms. This is like my go-to example these days. Like as an expecting mom, you want to have like a very good sense of here's what I should be doing to make sure I'm safe and the baby is safe, right? And it's like determined by so many things like your genetics, your medical history, your lifestyle, your social demographics. And what happens in the current system is you go and see your doctor maybe every 4 weeks and then you get like an ultrasound. It's like, yeah, the kid is like the heart's still beating. You're good to go. That's about the amount of advice that you get. There could be this amazing opportunity for expecting moms to say, we're going to pool our data in what is called a data co-op, which is like essentially a member-owned entity that's legally obligated to act in the best interest of their members. So it's like similar to financial institutions, right? They have these fiduciary responsibilities to act in the best interest of their customers. These data co-ops are essentially run by members. And they say, if we pool data, we can not only generate insights about how to have a healthy pregnancy overall, but we can also give you very specific recommendations. Think of it as like it's like the Netflix or Amazon of expecting moms. Is based on everything that I know about you, genetics, medical history, lifestyle, social demographics. Here's the best course of action. Here's the things that you might want to look out for. Here's maybe the nutrition that matters. Here's some of the lifestyle changes that you should be making. And so in this case, it's really saying because we're now many people, we're like many women, we have a lot more data to get better insights. But we also now, because we're coming together, can hire experts that make us like help us make use of the data, right? That could be building models. That could be saying, here's how we want to collaborate with maybe some companies who can then help us improve nutrition. And so you kind of all, because you're pooling the data, you benefit and you now have this support system that really allows you to say, here's what I'm trying to get out of it. And how do I do that in a way that preserves my privacy and gets me the most value?
Well put. Well, unfortunately, Sandra, we've run out of time, but I do want to remind our listeners that we've hardly covered all of this book. And I know they'll be anxious to see more of it in print. The name of the book is Mind Masters, The Data-Driven Science of Predicting and Changing Human Behavior. Its author, who joined us today at Reader's Corner, is Sandra Matz.
Thank you so much for having me.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The sound engineer for today's show is James Baker, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Custra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.